Jews believed were, what is it called? I don't even know what it's called. The beliefs of Judaism. It's a very strange kind of topic. Because if I asked you, do Jews have to believe anything to be Jewish? How many people would raise their hand and say yes? If I said, it's a small number. If I said, Judaism is a religion of deeds. Judaism's not a religion of faith or beliefs. How many people would agree? That's the most common definition of Judaism that we have, right? Judaism's deeds. And here we're going to do a session with people who have committed themselves to studying very seriously on Jewish beliefs. In fact, if there's one dogma in the Jewish community, it seems to me it's the dogma that Judaism has no dogma. What we call the dogma of dogmalessness. It's a rather strange thing. If you think about it even more, most Jews that you meet, and here's the irony, most Jews that you meet who will define, will agree with this definition, that Judaism really is a religion of deeds, and it's Christianity that's the religion of faith. Most of those Jews don't do the deeds that are defined as being Jewish. Instead, what do they say when you ask them if they're Jewish? What do they say? I feel Jewish. Okay, that maybe is the least sophisticated answer. What else do they say if they're a little bit more sophisticated? There's something special about being Jewish. I have Jewish identity. All of those things indicate that Jews have beliefs. When someone says, I have Jewish identity, but is not acting in any different way from their Christian neighbors, what they're really saying is that what distinguishes me, excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold. What they're really saying is that there are some central beliefs that distinguish me from my Christian neighbor. Even though I wear the same clothes, even though I do basically the same things, even though I work in the same workplace, I have some basic beliefs that distinguish me. So it's really ironic. The vast majority of Jews say, to be Jewish, you don't have to believe anything special. It's a matter of deeds. And those same vast majority of Jews say that what distinguishes them as Jews is Jewish identity, is their beliefs. You see the paradox? Everybody see that? It seems to me a very strange thing. Alright, so the first thing we have to ask ourselves is, where did this whole idea that Judaism has no beliefs, or to be Jewish doesn't necessitate any particular Jewish beliefs, come from? Because I'm going to question the whole hypothesis. And by the end of today, by the end of these 2-3 hours, what we're going to see is that there are some real central beliefs that underlie everything we do as Jews. And to the extent that we don't determine what those are and articulate them, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. Okay, so where did it all come from? Any suggestions on where this notion that Judaism is a religion of deeds and Christianity is a religion of faith, ideas where that came from? And we all said it. I mean, I was a pulpit rabbi for 6 years, and there were a lot of times I, who am a philosopher and a closet theologian, a lot of times got up and said, Judaism really emphasizes deeds, knowing that that wasn't really true. So where does it come from? Shelley?
Maybe it starts from the origin of Christianity, where the ultimate salvation comes from believing the right things. Think right, believe right, even further last minute, even if you're in a rocky place in your entire life, you believe and repent at the very end, you get the ultimate reward. I don't think that. So that's how Christianity in some way defines itself.
And so?
And Judaism doesn't operate that way.
Okay. I think that you've hit something very important, and that is one of the reasons that this has been such a prevalent way of defining Jews, especially for us, is that it was one of the ways to distinguish us from Christianity. In some sense, we had the understanding that Christianity was a religion of faith because they did away with a lot of the laws. And so, and as a way to distinguish ourselves, we were a religion of deeds. We acted. Okay? Although you should know that that it's codified by Maimonides already that you can be the worst son of a bitch in your whole life. And if you repent the moment before you're dead, everything's fine. But what does that sound like? Sounds like Christianity. Just goes to show that, see, the sources that are somewhat like Christianity hide from you. And the sources that paint out the differences, those are the ones we all know. So yes, Shelley, you're right, 100%. One of the reasons is this need to distinguish ourselves from Christianity. Good.
Well, John. Biblical references. Taking care of the deity, leaving the corn in the field, and I forget which of the books it's in. There's all kinds of the basis of the doctrine.
Okay, there seem to be so many, I think if I can rephrase, there seem to be so many laws within the Bible that it was natural for us to begin to think that we were a religion of laws and deeds rather than a religion of beliefs. Does that sound?
I'm not sure if I agree the rather than, but...
More primary than, right? Primary.
I'm not sure if I haven't thought about it in a sense, but there's plenty of references to the need to do good deeds in the Bible.
Okay. Any references to beliefs in the Bible?
Why isn't that a belief?
Good. That the whole need to do deeds is already underlined by a belief. Okay? How many people agree with that? Yeah. That's really, if there's one thing that I can get across today, it's that all systems have at its base certain beliefs out of which the system emerges and which power the system. Even if it's a system that's predominantly an active system of deeds rather than a faith-oriented internal system. So you're 100% right. And after all, everything that I've said in the last day about prayer and all that kind of stuff, I said, we see what we believe. Right? We come to the world with a whole set of beliefs, and then we see things and integrate them into that belief pattern. Right? The people saw the Exodus. The people experienced an event. But what they saw was very conditioned by what they believed. They believed God could act in history. Therefore, at the Exodus, what they saw was God acting in history. If you had someone else standing at the Exodus who did not already believe that God could act in history, which, by the way, was most of the pagan cults, that God didn't act in history, you wouldn't have seen God taking you across the Red Sea. So what you believe conditions what is really determines what you see. We studied Kaufman yesterday. Kaufman, we only read one chapter of Kaufman, but the whole two books of Kaufman make one argument. Funny when Herb says he hammers it in. You should read two volumes in Hebrew where he hammers in one idea in something like 800 pages. And there's only one idea in the whole book. I mean, they're always obvious. But there's really only one major proposition. And that is, what is unique about Judaism, created by Moses, is this crazy notion of monotheism. Or ethical monotheism. Is that a belief or an action? So the entire Kaufman book is dedicated to proving that what is unique about Jews is one belief. It's pretty wild. Okay. So we have one of the reasons we have this notion of religion of deeds, religion of belief, is distinguish us from Christianity. One of the reasons is that there seems to be, when you read the Bible, you concentrate on the kinds of deeds. We're now seeing the beliefs that are under even that understanding of deeds, what I'll call a theology of deeds, okay, or a belief system that undergird or foundational to deeds. Any other possibilities?
I think the reason that it's such a belief, but I'm not really sure that it's not a belief, because
Okay, so what you're saying is really a pedagogic. The Jews developed a pedagogic technique that rather than concentrating on beliefs first, we would concentrate on actions, and hopefully from even though all those actions, as you said, have as a foundation of a very serious belief system, by concentrating on action, we come to understand what we're supposed to believe rather than concentrating on belief. I think that that is a very important distinction between Judaism and Christianity. Okay? A pedagogical approach, in a sense, to life. Right? Rather than start with beliefs, start with actions, but get to beliefs. That's very Maimonidean. And rather than, as opposed to Christianity, which says start with a creed, a dogma, a set of beliefs that you can at least, even if you know only by rote, their reasoning is that it will affect your action. By the way, we have a misunderstanding of Christianity. I think Christianity doesn't have works. Faith and works are equally important in Christianity. And if you hear a good Christian preacher, they will, as much as they'll talk about faith, they'll talk about the implications that faith has towards actions. We do it, we take the opposite pedagogical approach, and we say, if you do the right act, it's amazing what you'll come to believe. Okay, so I think that's good. That pedagogical approach is maybe the difference in emphasis. Good. That's a similar point, okay, that you can't get to the understanding, you can't get to the beliefs without the acting. But the acting is a concretization of the beliefs, not the other way around. Right? When you read about the Shabbat in the Torah, what you read about is the belief system that undergirds the Shabbat. And if there wasn't a belief system undergirding the Shabbat, what would you have? Would anybody observe Shabbat? In fact, it may well be that one of the reasons in the American Jewish community there's such little observance of Shabbat is because since we haven't plugged into the beliefs and understandings of Shabbat at all, or that most of those beliefs are out, we no longer feel comfortable with, there's no observance of Shabbat. So we may be in a position now where it's counterproductive to be teaching deeds over faith. Right.
Well, maybe we're getting semantics. Maybe this goes back to the dogma versus belief, but I would violently disagree with what Ron just said. I'm not violent.
He has a passive understanding of violence.
if Shabbat is dogma, then the way that Joe Williams practices Shabbat, or the way that I practice Shabbat, according to what Ron just said, is a total non-belief in Shabbat. And I don't believe that. I mean, I think Shabbat is as important to me the way as I practice it, as it is Ron, the way he does, or everybody else is doing it. I think that if, in fact, Shabbat is dogma, then the way we do it, I think it's something like Joe, but I mean, I have to be a little bit more familiar with. I think Joe practices a lot the way I do, and I mean, to me, Shabbat's very important, and I don't believe that what I do is not indicative of Shabbat,
Let's clarify terms. It looks like that we need to clarify terms of language. We always have to be very precise about language. This is what, from the Oxford English Dictionaries, you know, that's a pretty good source. On what dogma means. There's two definitions of dogma primarily. One is a body of opinion formulated and authoritatively, and that's the key word there, authoritatively stated. Okay? Another definition of dogma is a belief. 10. Now, this type of dogma we Jews don't have. Why? We don't have single authority. That's the only reason. In fact, we have a body of opinion formulated and stated. From the biblical times till last year, at least in the conservative movement, they published a book called what? Anybody know? Emet, the Emunah. What's Emet? Truth, right? Truth is an action. Truth is a belief word, right? Truth and Emunah. Faith, truth and belief, really, belief is better, that's what they call it. Truth and belief. Here, in an age where we talk about Jews as Jews, religion of deeds, not religion of faith, the conservative movement publishes a book called Belief, Truth and Belief. Okay, so we have plenty of body of opinion formulated today. We have beliefs and tenets. The only problem is we don't have any authorities. By the way, you can bet your life that if we ever had a society in which we did have one authority, we would have as much dogma in this sense as the Catholic Church. Just look at the state of Israel when it has a chief rabbi. Right? Life is a conservative conversion or reform conversion done exactly according to Orthodox law, considered invalid by Orthodoxy. What? What? In fact, the conversion is going to be a rabbi. The Bible says you don't need a rabbi for conversion.
But it doesn't describe the authority in Israel.
No. You know why? You talk to Orthodox rabbis, you know what the answer they will give you? Because if I do a conversion, I who live traditionally, halakhically, and if you talk a reform rabbi who lives, let's say, according to an orthodox halakha, and who converts according to halakha, with making sure that the person's kosher, making sure, let's say, even the person doesn't drive to shul, that the person's in shul every Shabbos, and all the things that would be, let's say, it was an orthodox kind of halakha, everything. The reason is not, is because of the belief of Torah from Sinai. If you don't believe Torah is from Sinai, you can't be a witness within the Orthodox community today. That's a what? Belief or an action? That's belief. And I told you about conservative Judaism and that they're not. So they clearly are very concerned about beliefs. The whole book is about beliefs. And Reform Judaism, I mean, when you look at the beginnings of Reform Judaism, Reform Judaism almost adopted a church-like kind of formulation of what Judaism was in all of its platforms. They put out creedal statements. So here we are talking about Judaism as a religion of deeds. And all around us, since biblical times, what we really argued about and what really has distinguished us is what we believe. Ask Elijah when he killed 200 Baal prophets, what was important, beliefs or actions. What about the tension between monarchy and prophets? Those are about beliefs. Or first century Judaism, Sadducees and Pharisees, they killed each other. Over what? They were living basically the same way. But one group believed in freedom of will, and the other one believed in fate. One group believed in resurrection, the other group believed no resurrection. One group believed in a hereafter, another group didn't believe in a hereafter, so they killed each other. What about Kabbalists, who talk about God in the most passionately sexual terms? And anti-Kabbalists, who live exactly the same way. What about Hasidim and Mithrafi, who actually jailed each other using the secular authorities because of belief differences, which obviously did have action implications. And of course, like you say, conservative Orthodox, well, what about Maimonides himself? We're going to study him a little bit. But you know, we don't recognize that Maimonides' books were burned during this time. The Book of Ideas, the Moran Yuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed. By the way, that was the Guide for the Perplexed. A perplexed is somebody who is confused. The Yuchim literally means confused. What are you confused about? You're confused in your mind about what to believe. So he writes this whole book about what you're supposed to believe. And in fact, he says, and he writes another book for what you're supposed to do, called the Mishnah Torah. Okay, so he writes two books. One an action book, and one a philosophy belief book, although you should know, and even that dichotomy is not fair, because in the introduction to his action book, the whole first part is on beliefs. And he says, a person who is the worst person in the world, who believes the right things, is still within the community. He's just called a sinner in Israel. A person who does the right things, in other words, does the mitzvot, but doesn't have the beliefs, can be an idolater. Sound Jewish to you? What about Philo, who lived in 20 CE? Writes a whole book about beliefs. What about Mordechai Kaplan? You know what they did to his books? Yes, we always do it in books, we're great. Burn Mordechai Kaplan's books. I don't know if you know Mordechai Kaplan was from. You know, he was the founder of Young Israel. You know that? Mordechai Kaplan was the founder of the Young Israel movement in this country. We don't talk about that too much because it's not nice to think of a heretic as the founder of Orthodoxy, modern Orthodoxy in the country, or the modern Orthodoxy congregational movement. Now, he did leave that after a while because his beliefs, not his actions. I had the opportunity of visiting Mordechai Kaplan when he was 99 years old. Got in with somebody who was one of my teachers. Mordechai Kaplan's home was an Orthodox home. Mordechai Kaplan's brain was not an Orthodox brain.
His grandson
was on his name. So ask him. Ask him. Books burn. So I got a feeling that beliefs had been very important to Jews. They killed each other over beliefs.
But perhaps the only time that we really got into trying to look for the beliefs of the underpinnings of our religion is in response to the religions around us to find their religion that way.
Beautiful. Okay, now we have to ask the question. If I've just shown you, by the way, we forgot a very important character, Spinoza. Right? I think that if we had Spinoza back here and maybe put him in the middle since he's used to being under attack, if we put Spinoza in the middle and said, are beliefs important? Chances are Spinoza, who was excommunicated from the community, would say, oh yeah, are beliefs important to this people? I think your point's very well taken. We've got to ask the question. When has the agitation about beliefs been most at the forefront? 20 years ago, right, none of you would be in a room agitating about beliefs. And I don't mean you, but your parents. Who were active in the Jewish community, let's say, and who worked for the Jewish community would not be agitated about beliefs to the same extent you are now. Let's ask, when are we most agitated about our beliefs? Now, one answer, and that's 100% correct, is when we are involved in a society around us, when the society is very open to us, and when we're challenged both intellectually and religiously from cultures around us, we have a tendency to develop and articulate our beliefs, i.e. what distinguishes us. And all those characters that I mentioned lived in periods like that. Philo lived in the midst of an unbelievable Hellenistic environment. Hellenism, think of Hellenism at that period like Americanism now. It's the Western civilization of its day. it was cosmopolitan, and it was wonderful, and it was art, and the best architecture, and the best philosophy, and the best music, and the best science. It was everything. So Philo was confronted by the intellectual and spiritual challenges, and so articulated a set of beliefs. He, by the way, he narrowed down Judaism to five beliefs that all Jews have to have. Okay, so I think that's one answer. And Maimonides, the same thing. Maimonides would never have written that book if it wasn't that he was challenged by the Kalam, K-A-L-A-A-M. The Kalam was Muslim philosophy. It's not fair exactly, but that's a simple way to look at it. Muslim religious philosophy, which was very creative, which was very challenging, and he lived in a society in which it was, at least when he got to Egypt, it was pretty open. I mean, the guy became the doctor to the soul. You know, that's better than Kissinger. You know, you got to see the king naked, you probed him. It was pretty vulnerable. Only Lyndon LaRouche thinks that Kissinger got to do that. All of these characters, Mordechai Kaplan too. Mordechai Kaplan lived in an age in which Mordechai Kaplan, I'm always worried when that happened, but Kaplan lived in an age in which society was becoming incredibly open in a narrow way.
Thanks.
The challenges of philosophy stimulated him to think about what Judaism really should be. So yes, that's a very, very important point. At all times of interaction, there is this worrying about what beliefs we have. Okay? Any other possibilities?
It doesn't seem to me that, notwithstanding the examples that are cited in the Dogma here, and the modern day ones that you cited, it seems to me the central underpinning of Jewish life up until modern times has been the Talmud and applying the Talmud to everyday life. Central understanding has not been the recitation of the catechism that we must ascribe to.
Right.
And the Talmud spent the majority of its time dealing with how to practice. Yes, some of it a matter of rituals, but a good deal of it in matters of everyday life, commerce, how to interact with other people.
Okay.
And very little time is spent in it talking about the believing in God as the big central. But even the tractate of beliefs for Talmud all usually defines, you know, what we need to do, who is righteous in terms of being more than anything else.
Okay. Jacob Neusner, who is one of the, probably he'll go down in history as one of the greatest scholars in the latter half of the 20th century, because he's setting the agenda on what questions to ask about Jewish texts, will say to you, that's because you have studied the Talmud with people who have absolutely no understanding of the Talmud. That the Talmud really is one of the most sophisticated belief systems articulated in the history of religion. And he makes such a persuasive case that Christian universities like St. John's are now studying Talmud, because the only way to understand the Jewish belief system is to understand how the Talmudic rabbis put these, what he calls pericopes, which is like short paragraphs, together that were all seemingly on the outside dealing with actions, but had as a foundation in the way they were put together unbelievable statements of belief. So that's even being challenged.
Can I speak up for my teachers for a
minute? Yeah, of course.
Most of the things in the Talmud, when they try, I mean, it accepts the divine giving of the Torah. I think it's an underpinning of the Talmud. But they still try and use logical principles to arrive at their conclusions, using the text to putting text against text. And it is rare in the Talmud, but occasionally, that the father says the only reason for this is Torah and Moshe and Sinai. Most things in the Talmud are arrived at by a matter of reason.
Most beliefs are arrived at by a matter of reason. Most beliefs have premise one, premise two, premise three. If you accept the premises, accept the conclusion. Same as legal tradition. Legal tradition has step one, step two, step three. If you accept that, then you get the derivation of the law.
The potential underpinning of the Jewish belief and how it's translated, Kaplan said in his article, was that the last five commandments, probably other people ascribed to those beliefs as well, but what was important was that it was now given not just a general morality, but that this is God and a monotheistic approach.
So you just said exactly what I've been saying the last 20 minutes. The real central thing was the belief. There was God and that there was a monotheistic approach. You just proved what I just said. And you use the Ten Commandments. They're a wonderful thing. The Ten Commandments, we think of commandments as things you have to do. But what's the first commandment? It's a belief. Right? Maimonides says without that belief, there are no commandments. These are the real tensions within the tradition. You're right that there's no catechism. That's true. But that's because we don't have an authority figure. And there's no list of beliefs that we have to recite every day. Although that's not true, 100%. How many people like the song? Like that song? Right? All that is Maimonides' 13 principles of faith, rearticulated in poetry, that we have used in song form. That is sung in Reformed congregations, right? And if Reformed Jews knew what they were singing in Adon Olam, I'm sure they'd strike it out, right? One of the things we're going to study is that one of the things that they're saying is that the Torah was dictated from God, word to word, to Moses, who wrote it down, and that's the same Torah we got in our book now. I don't think there are very many Reformed Jews who believe that. Or the 12th principle that says resurrection of the dead. I don't think there are many Reformed Jews that believe that. And yet we all sing Adon Olam. And Maimonides himself said, if you don't believe these 13 things, you're a kofar, you're a heretic, you're an idolater, you're outside the community. Now, I'm making a very strong case, I know, and so that's why you're objecting a little bit. And what I want to say, where I think some of the objection comes from, is that there is this heavy biological understanding of Judaism, that you're automatically a Jew if you're born a Jew, okay? So that heavy biological connection makes everything unimportant in relation to you really being a Jew. But by the way, that makes belief as unimportant as it makes actions. And we don't understand that. Right? You can do everything wrong as a Jew. You can transgress every ethical and ritual, quotation marks, commandment, and every belief that's ever been brought down. And we still have this crazy understanding that we can still be Jewish. That's our biological aspect of Judaism. How many people are comfortable with that? Yes?
That you can still be Jewish, or that you can still be a Jew?
That you're still a Jew. I'm sorry. That you're still a Jew. So in that sense, there's nothing you have to believe to be a Jew. But there's nothing you in that sense, there's nothing you have to do to be a Jew either. So, but how many people are comfortable with that heavy biological? Everybody's really happy about that? You got the worst human being in the world.
You first said comfortable, now you're saying uncomfortable. I don't think people
are comfortable. Who's uncomfortable with this notion that no matter who you are, no matter how bad a human being you are, no matter what your beliefs are, your mother's a Jew, you're a Jew, how many people, like, really comfortable with that? How many people are really uncomfortable with that? Sure, you're not uncomfortable with that at all?
I mean, you can be a really bad black person, still black. You can be a really bad Chinese, still Chinese.
Oh, good. So, in other words, for you, Judaism really is a race.
No, I'm not saying it's a race. I'm saying if you're a person, you're still a person.
So,
if you're a rotten person, you're still a person.
Oh, well, no one's saying they're not a person. God forbid. A person's a person. I'm saying is the person a Jew?
You can have a terrible mother, but you're still your mother.
It's not exclusionary. It's not the only way.
Your mother's your mother. Well, how? Because of what?
Biological.
The genetics, right?
Right.
A black is a black because of what?
Okay, well.
Genetics. Chinese
your mother
is Chinese.
A Jew, you're a Jew.
Because of what?
Father name or Orthodox.
But because according to everybody.
Are you comfortable with father name or being a Jew? He's a Jew. He's a Jew. A good Jew,
maybe. I'm saying he's a Jew. The system says he's a Jew. I'm asking you if you're comfortable with Father Daniel being a Jew.
Ideal.
Oh, it's not ideal, but we're so scared to disagree with the tradition. God, what happened to the 60s?
One person.
It'd be much more discomfiture. That was the only way to be a Jew.
Right.
And not the only way. It's not that uncomfortable proposition. I mean, after all, there's always the possibility that someone's born a Jew, and that's their only entitlement, as it were, could one day become a better act out for a Jew. But it's not the only way to become a Jew.
That's true. We have conversion. And it's funny. You know what we do to converts? I mean, we do a lot of bad things to converts, but you know what we do to converts? Across the board, from right-wing orthodoxy to left-wing reform, you know what we make them take? And, in a lot of cases, that's a form of punishment, I do know. But you know what we make them take? After they get out of the mikvah? An affirmation of faith. Ask any convert from right-wing orthodoxy to left-wing reform if they have to recite the Shema as their entrance ceremony.
You'd ask them if they
No one's saying. But that's committing themselves to belief too. So it's funny that a convert, we have to commit them, we make it a very significant point to commit them to a belief system. But a Jew, genetically, is always a Jew. So I think that tension that a genetic Jew is always a Jew, which taken to the logical extreme, does become racist, by the way.
Why?
Because of the only reason you're a Jew is genetic.
Not only all Jews.
No. Bottom line is the reason all Jews who have Jewish parents are Jewish.
Right, but it's not a reason that all Jews are Jewish. Not all Jews have Jewish mothers.
That's correct. Those people, we make sure that they have the right beliefs and the right actions.
That's an important distinction.
But I think don't you see a little bit of irony in that? That you can have this. Well, Brother Daniel's a good example, really. You can have this guy who says he is Jewish because his mother was Jewish. He lives like a Brother Daniel. He lives like a Christian. What did the Israel government decide about that? The halakha decides what on that person?
Chief rabbi never had to make a decision.
The
decision was made by the Supreme Court.
Right, what I'm saying. What would the chief rabbi say about that person?
They didn't, but I think they would have to have said he was a Jew.
Yeah, of course. The halakha says he's Jewish. What did the Supreme Court say? Not Jewish. The Supreme Court's decision was based on what?
Fact.
On fact. It was based on belief. Not biology, right. Well, belief, not biology. Or belief / action, which are equal, and not the non-biological.
A lot of this has to do with the ability of the allocation of resources as a community. We don't allocate much more time and effort to belief, except for the power. We allocate a lot of more time and effort to tribe. If you look at our body of literature, or if you look at our actual activities, we spend a lot more time involved in caring for the tribe, in distress most of the time. Tribal life is passed to tribal Christians. That's already action of sorts. So we have Wanderers, we have Chris, we have Shiva, and things like that. But so we say we're action oriented because that's where we spend our time, our total resource, and we come to the conversation.
Okay, but my point is that every single one of those actions has as a foundation very serious beliefs. And when it doesn't, what happens to those actions? They water down and stop being done. And in ages of great openness to the community, where there's tremendous intellectual challenge, that's exactly what happens. When we don't articulate our beliefs. There's one other, just move on so we can have one more point in the hop, but there's one other time when there's tremendous agitation about beliefs. You said when there's openness. Anybody ever, one other time that I can, in my sense of Jewish history.
The opposite.
okay, when there's persecution, which means when there's some kind of catastrophe that happens within the Jewish people, and there's a tremendous agitation about beliefs. That's correct. We have a few great examples. After the destruction of the first temple, right? Isaiah 2, okay, and Ezekiel, who lived post-destruction of the temple. In a sense, we define everything that we talk about God and the relationship between God and human beings. And I'm sure during your seminars in the next 2 years, one of the things you will do is study the prophetic periods. I don't want to go into it now, but very fundamental distinctions about what it is to believe there's a Jew. Same with the first century destruction, right, by the Romans. That the Judaism of 200 CE would be unrecognizable to the in the Judaism of 200 BCE. The beliefs were so different. And because the beliefs were so different, obviously what else is different? The practice was so different. Now, if this is a right theory, and I think it is, okay, it also means that in an age like ours, when we have both openness and key events, I think the key events are the Holocaust, obviously, and the establishment of the state of Israel. When you have two key events like that, it's going to force the system to rethink its basic premises, to rethink its basic beliefs. Which means we're in an age, and this is why what we're doing is so critical, we're in an age that's beginning to redefine what it means to be Jewish. We've gotten away the last 35 years, 40 years without doing it. You know why? Because we've been so busy just surviving post-Holocaust. Right? How many people raise money based on Jewish survival here? All that means when I say that, that's just a fancy word, that's just a simple way of saying you bring in Holocaust, you bring in persecution, you bring in that everybody's against us, you bring in those kinds of issues. Every movement helps, and that helps a lot, right? Jewish survival. What are we learning in fundraising now? Anybody who's active in fundraising, we were just talking, Joe and I were talking yesterday about what's going on in training, in UJA training seminars. All of a sudden, we had a half hour of what, Joe? And you specifically said one thing about Judaism. When they talk about what?
Covenant.
A covenant's not an action word. Covenant's a belief word. You need to believe there's a relationship, it somehow exists between God and man, and its power, this whole civilization, or you don't. That is a pretty weird thing to be talking about it as solicitation. Herb, I don't know, but in the solicitations of 25 years ago,
okay.
And I'm not an expert in that, but he's the expert probably in the world in that. Chances are, if you talked about covenant, you're a wealthy person. I don't know what he would do. But you didn't talk about covenant. You didn't talk about beliefs. Why all of a sudden are we talking about beliefs?
Trying to give the solicitor a sense of purpose.
Once you got survival guaranteed, then you know what question you got to answer? Once survival is guaranteed, and survival, Jewish people's survival is guaranteed. I mean, Herb made a case yesterday. Israel's survival is not at stake. Individual people in Farsaba and Metula and when you have a terrorist, they're at stake. But the survival of the Jewish people is not at stake right now. So once you get the survival down, what do you got to answer? What question?
Why?
Why survive? Is it an action question or a belief question?
Please.
It's a belief question. Because once you answer the question why, then what would be the answer? Then you'll be able to act on it. Once you answer the question why, then you got a chance of getting some money to take care of the why. Now we're in, it happens to be, for whatever reasons, and this is God's little game with us, we're the generation that is responsible to answer the why. Much like that first century, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai left the temple and knew the temple was going to be destroyed, and all those zealots were going to be destroyed, and the rest of them would get killed at Masada, and he knew it was all over for that whole expression of Jewish life. And he went up to Yavden, and he went to Tveria. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai knew, unfortunately, probably wasn't so happy about it, okay, that he was going to have to redefine Judaism. You know how long it took? Well, the Talmud, remember, when was the Jerusalem and Babylon? Babylonian Talmud was finished when? 500, 550. That, in a sense, was the encyclopedia of Judaism. Belief, action, everything. It's not systematic, so we get more action stuff than we think than belief, but that's only because it's not systematic. But at 550, you got the Judaism. The faith basically lasted until 1750, 1720, around Moses and Mendelssohn's time, Spinoza's. To 400 years. Now, one of the things I learned from her is that history moves faster once we hit modernity with technology and communications and all the kinds of things that we have that make this modern. History itself moves faster. So 400 years of movement between 200 and 550 or 200 and 600 may be equal to 50 years of movement in this age. That's one of the things I learned. It makes a lot of sense. You know, because it took the Babylonian Talmud in Pukhavita to get to Palestine a hell of a lot longer than it takes to get a message that's figured out in a university in New York to Houston. And I learned that this week because I left a very important part of my work in New York. I got here in Houston at 12 o'clock and I had a fax machine about 25 minutes later. It's an amazing thing. So I learned, yeah, history is compressed. So instead of a generation together in every city in this country, we hope it grows past the cities we're in now. I better get these young people together and better get them thinking about the why, or would there be any heat patrol? That's the stakes of what we're now going to do for the rest of this session. We're going to begin the why. If we don't come up with a good why, okay, or at least the beginnings of a why, or at least the discomfort of not having a why yet, we are in very big trouble. And it's not only going to happen here, but we're talking about doing it all. And the truth is, this is a wonderful exercise for all the Jewish people to be doing it. And it's probably the exercise that happened in Rabbi Yochanan's academy. And it's probably the exercise that happened in Maimonides' discussion rooms with his students. It happened at all those important moments in history. And that's one of the moments we're living in now. So now let's go to the why. Now how do you start in Judaism with answering a question like why? How do you start? Yeah, we ask another question. Well, let's say that we got to the bottom line question. How do we do it? Well, it seems to me there are two approaches to answering a question like why. We can open up to the law, right? And we can say, what do you think? And we can make a big list and argue about it. Right? What's the problem with that approach? Too much like an allocation. What's the problem with that approach? Well, I don't know. Maybe you can come up with a very nice list. I bet you we can come up maybe even with this. Well, we'll see about the other approach. We can come up with a list that I bet you most of the people here would agree on, which would be very powerful and which would we can send around and get people to talk about it, and would really be very effective. What's the problem with doing it? Is authority, okay.
How would you get accepted?
Okay. Maybe instead of authority, let me use the word legitimacy. In some sense, from what we understand about Judaism, it would be somewhat illegitimate because it starts here as opposed to starting where?
Well, it wouldn't start here. What the ideas we would come up with would be what was in the Bible and the why.
Oh, okay.
The why was answered 3,500 years ago. We've just
some of the whys. Right? We have to rework the whys.
Right.
Good. So what really you're saying is that what we have to do is begin at the beginning in some sense. Look at all the answers to the whys up to now. Reinterpret some of those whys, strike out some of those whys, recast some of those whys, rework some of those whys until we have the answers to the whys that fit our generation. Okay? So in other words, to make it continuous somehow with Moses at Sinai, we have to at least start by looking at the answers that were given there. That's why, what do we do most in these sessions? We study texts. We don't just bullshit around. Right? That's what they do in synagogues, by the way. for the most part in classes. We bullshit around. What do you believe? No. Jews decide what they believe based on an interaction between themselves and their texts. Whatever those texts are. That text can be a Kaufman. That text can be Exodus. That text can be Kaplan. That text can be Maimonides. It doesn't make a difference what the text is, but an interaction with the texts. So we're going to start with what is the classic formulation of articles of faith or principles, and that is Maimonides. If you open up your dogma article, there's one thing that's great about this article. It's a terrible article, but there's one thing that's great about the article. Is that it's short, that's a great thing, right? Especially post-Kaufman. I'm thinking when I saw what Herb gave you, okay, I had no chance of beginning to read anything that was like that. So I'm thinking I'll give you an easy article. But here's the funny thing about that article. The first page and a half deals with proving one issue. What is that? Because Judaism has no dogma. The rest of the article deals with what? Dogmas of Judaism. The guy, Menachem Kelder, I know Menachem Kelder, he just couldn't accept the fact that Judaism has dogma. So he writes this whole article about dogma, prefacing it by saying Jews have no dogma. The article should have been over it the first page. And he didn't unpack Crescas, and he didn't unpack Albo, and he didn't unpack Salvia, and he didn't unpack, how could he unpack anybody who all have dogmas in the notion of beliefs, and hence, that are the basis to the system. Okay, let's look at, we just, in one sentence review, what we said is Judaism does have dogma, that it's the foundation of any system of life. Any system of life has to say things about God, has to say things about the world, has to say fundamental things about man that you believe, out of which emerges action. We said that the struggle to articulate beliefs basically happens most when you can interact with society and the challenges of society, and when there are fundamental catastrophic events externally that happen to the Jewish people, forces us to reevaluate. And finally, we said, we're in that age. And we're in that age in a very serious way, because we maybe only have 50 years to begin to rearticulate. By the way, if you ever read, let me read a book called Sacred Survival. I think it's on the Wesleyan list. Sacred Survival by Jonathan Lucher, which he talks about civil Judaism. And he says in that, in civil Judaism is a kind of Judaism is emerging in America. And he says, when a simple Judaism will be able to be transmitted to the next generation will be dependent on whether it can develop a system of beliefs that they can articulate that underlies civil Judaism. The whole last chapter, you must read the last chapter in that book. The first truth is you have to be the first chapter and the last chapter. Everything else in between you know intuitively. Okay, it's a very important book to read.
Question, comment,
words,
age. Why are we in that age?
Okay, these are some of the reasons we're in that age. One is that we have never lived in a society that is more open than America in the history of Jewish people. Would you agree with that? Never in the history of the Jews have we lived in such an open society. So automatically, the challenges to articulate beliefs that distinguish us from a non-Jew become critical. Okay, so that's one reason. The second is we have experienced in the generation before us, not really our generation, the two most significant events in Jewish history since the destruction of the Second Temple. And that is the Holocaust, which was as great a catastrophe as, if not greater, than the destruction of the Temple. And second, the establishment of the State of Israel, which changes the categories of Judaism. When was the last time we had a state? 60, 70, and even, listen, truth is, even in that beginning of the first century, it's not like we had a great state. Okay, the Rome was really running. So we haven't had a state, and we haven't had all the things that power means and sovereignty means, and it's changed the categories of the way we think about Judaism. And if you don't believe that, why do we have Jews who don't observe the Shabbat, who don't observe Kashrut, who don't observe any of the things that, and who don't believe any of the things that Jews have believed for the last 2,000 years, but somehow, because they work night after night to the State of Israel, we recognize as good Jews, and we recognize as people who have a Jewish, strong Jewish identity. It's a very interesting phenomenon. It indicates that there's something happening in our era. There's a redefinition going on. The same kind of redefinition that happened in the first century. So the stakes, I believe, are very high. Also, I mean, here's an example. Why does a thing like the Wexner Heritage Foundation happen? It only happens because we people who are making decisions to have this thing believe we're in a very serious, we got some serious issues to address. And the stakes are pretty high. So high that we have to do it in every city. We have to come with spend time and incredible amounts of money. That's how high the stakes are. Not to get you to raise money. We don't ask you for one penny. Probably the only foundation in the United States of America that doesn't ask its participants for money. The Jewish Foundation, I mean. All we want you to do is think about what? Ideas. We don't even really ask you to do anything. We didn't demand that you pray yesterday. We gave an opportunity for you to experience prayer. Chose not to pray, we wouldn't have thrown you out of the program. We don't demand that you keep kosher. We don't demand that you wear a yarmulke. If you came last yesterday without a yarmulke at the prayer, no one would have said, I would have said anything to you. Come without a palace. Because what are we about? We're about ideas. Right? So that all these are indications, and I can give you a list of thousands, but all these are indications that we're living in some kind of different time. Okay, so now look at the article on dogma on page 143. It's good to, like I said, we're just going to start with my mind. What time is it?
It's 20 after 10.
Great. Okay, these are Maimonides' 13 principles. Okay, we're starting with them. And let's go through them, see what Maimonides meant by them, and I'll have to help you with that. And then see if we can put it on the board as something that ought to be entertained in the list that by 12 o'clock we will have created. Okay? What's the first one? God exists. Okay? Always start with one of the most difficult ones. That God exists. What does Maimonides mean? Well, it doesn't say that.
Well, implicit in the word God is not explain the concept of the omnipotent creator of created time, the world, the universe, and create us.
Okay, how many people comfortable with that? How many people comfortable with the notion that God exists? How many people ready to say, I believe in God? By the way, my mother is Ani Ma'in Ben Munash Shleima. I believe in perfect faith. Well, that wasn't his language, that was later language. I always say, but it says, I believe in perfect faith that. For me already, anything after that is problematic because for me the perfect is a problem. Right? I have perfect faith. Anybody here have perfect faith? In anything? No, that's one of the casualties of modernity. You don't have any perfect faith in anything. So we can write, I tentatively believe in. And I'm willing to, you know, stake some of my actions and some of my life on. So what do we say about God exists? Should we put it on the board and come back to it? Or do we want to strike it right away? How many people comfortable with striking God exists right away? All right, we're not ready to do that.
This is basic.
Am I crazy or what?
This is basic.
Any responses? The thunder cloud, even in pain.
What is there if we don't have God?
Really? The higher moral
power. There's got to be something.
If you believe in this dog...
One person. Okay, so you're making a case to believe that God exists.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I think David's making a case that God does exist. Gary? Okay, so for you then, God has moral authority distinguishes a moral set of beliefs from an immoral set of beliefs?
Without a God, there's no
religion. There's no what?
They're all relative.
Are atheists all immoral?
Some are.
And some believers in God are and aren't either. Is there a necessary connection between God and morality?
Yes.
Is there?
It makes it not relative. I mean, our friend in California, the expert on the non-relative morality, he says it's relative to an age if you don't go back to a belief in God.
Okay, Dennis Prager, who I think Joe's referring to, Dennis Prager, makes an unbelievably articulate, and I could never match it in this area, an unbelievably articulate argument that God as a moral base, without God as a moral base, you have ish hayashar ve'einav. Everybody can do what they feel is right. What do we call that? Anarchy. Did I say that once before?
Yeah.
That's because really deep down I am an anarchist. I repress it all. But, so, a lot of us are uncomfortable without God. Because God exists means God as moral arbiter. And that doesn't mean that God says do this or do that. But in our understanding of God, we use that as an authority. Okay? By the way, that was a fairly radical idea. Right? In biblical times, God and morality was detached for most peoples. Right? Think of the Noah story. The Noah story has its parallels in other cultures. One of the most famous is called the Epic of Gilgamesh. I'm sure you're going to study about these things during the next few seminars. But the Epic of Gilgamesh says, you know why the world was destroyed? Because people were making too much noise and disturbing the gods. In Noah's story, why are people destroyed? People that are immoral. So the Jewish authors of the Bible, or for those people who are not comfortable with that, the Jewish author with a capital A of the Bible, there's no difference to me, posited that there's a connection between God and morality. It's a very radical thing. Okay, so we're going to put up God exists. I guess I didn't have, unless I would love to hear somebody have a strong objection.
Well, not a strong objection.
Oh, I like that. Shelley argues both sides. Good shoot.
On the other hand, about this morality issue, every time I talk about God, this morality issue comes up. It troubles me because when it's invoked in the morality issue, I'm never sure what it's referring to as a dogma of our belief of the way we should behave, or as a no-no to everybody who's not Jewish, that that's why they should behave a certain way.
Okay, so what you're saying is there, even in all beliefs, there are dangers where the beliefs are misunderstood. The notion that God is the arbiter or ultimate ground for morality can, if used improperly, wind up being very judgmental on other peoples who have different systems of morality. Okay? And that's a fair criticism, which means there are going to have to be checks and balances within our belief system.
I think Shelley's question might be more specific.
No, I think you're exactly right. Also, kind of the flip side of survival issue versus
good. Right. These are, again, every time I'm talking to you, we always find what we call the dialectic. You got one side, but it's left to the extreme, you need to correct it. So I think that that's a very good point. But what we can say is that all cultures do have senses of morality. In all cultures, murder is wrong. It's just how you define murder. In all cultures, theft is wrong. It's just how you define theft. So there is some kind of ground of morality that transcends the human mind, Prager would say. And that fundamentally is what God exists. Okay, so any arguments? I mean, I don't want to put anything on the board that this group doesn't come to consensus about. All right.
I can't really systematize this software.
It's okay.
God doesn't exist.
just saying that it's not necessarily the ultimate decision-making factor.
Okay, so you're saying let's have two lists. Let's have a list of things that are necessary, right? Necessary and sufficient. There are two different kinds of things. But let's have a list. Let's have a list of things that are absolutely necessary, and let's have another list of things that we strongly recommend. Okay? You can have a person who buys into the whole system, who says, well, this is a morality that moves me individually. It makes sense to me individually. It seems like what goodness is to me individually. And therefore, I am going to adopt it. And that person truly is a good Jew.
How can you be a good Jew if you don't believe in this
man? No, he's saying just the opposite. He's saying, believe in the Ten Commandments. Okay? He doesn't say the Ten Commandments that God gave him. That's one of the things you have to believe. He says, believe in all the actions. Here's what he's saying. I think this is what he's saying. That you have a human being who is born Jewish, let's say that way, okay, who observes most of the rituals and ethical practices of Judaism and believes that they're really valuable, and they move him individually, and he adopts them because individually they sound right. They may even give him pleasure. But the person says, listen, God, we're all creation of man. We happen to be we were a kind of people that really worked hard on working out a system that would be for the betterment of man. It came out of our own minds. And it's a good system. God, don't need God. And that person would be, what you're saying, that person, I think we would say, is Jewish. And a good Jew. Maybe even a great Jew. Maybe we need more Jews like that.
What?
Did I do it?
Yeah. You can keep running
right.
Through to get to some real intellectual abstract concepts. Maybe that's how you work to say God exists.
By the way, that's not so radical. Right? Mordechai Kaplan said, supernatural God? What are you talking about? Come on, guys, it's time to grow up. Okay, by the way, he was very hard on people who studied with him. Most of the piece, he taught in the seminary for 40 years, most of the piece, which is a conservative movement, and most of the people who were in the seminary in the 40 years that he taught came out of yeshiva. And from what I hear, I never obviously studied with Mordechai Kaplan, what he would do in the big first 3 or 4 weeks of the class would abuse anyone who believed that God dictated the Torah. Abuse people. He would call them, you're stupid. And then he would reconstruct, and then the last half of this year, he would reconstruct the construction. He would reconstruct Jewish beliefs based on the understanding that all peoples have beliefs, that the beliefs come from the internal dynamics of a people, or what we call the civilization. So civilization is created. It comes from the inside. There's a people's ethos. There's a people. They're the things that make us up as people. And that God is the power within that pushes towards goodness, that pushes towards perfection, that pushes towards development of civilization. That is not, by the way, probably most Jews believe a God kind of like that. It shows the influence Kaplan really had. So, complete rejection, that's why they wrote this book, by the way. A lot of people didn't like that idea.
I have a problem. I know God, I think that God exists, but he's not always there. I mean, I don't understand the concept of the Holocaust where, you know, God said it's a war, it's what man did to man. You know, I think he should have been there. I mean, I guess I was disappointed in God that he didn't do something. I know half the people came out saying their faith made them survive.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would have been one of the ones coming out saying, you know, where was God when we needed
him? Very honest.
So I have a problem with his always being...
Okay, so you're saying, if I can rephrase that, you're not going to take... It's not that you don't say God exists. It's that you're very troubled by God hiding. Okay, what Buber called... By the way, I'm using all these names, not to show off, but I'm using all these names because these are people who struggled with beliefs. And it's those struggles that determine the kind of Jewish people we are. That's what I'm trying to get across. It's the only reason I'm using these names. Martin Buber called that the eclipse of God. It's an eclipse hidden, right? Richard Rubinstein called it the death of God. Mordechai Kaplan, who really could never deal with the issue of the Holocaust, in a sense, what he would say was, hey, listen, guys, you know, there comes a point where God hides himself so much. If God hides himself 99.9999999% of the time, you know, it's not such a big difference between that and 100%. If God hides himself 100% of the time, for all practical purposes, what? For all practical purposes, what? Don't worry, I promise, no thunder. Doesn't exist. So, the problem of evil has really been a serious problem. In the Bible, they have the problem of evil, too. What's the book that deals with the problem of evil? Good, Job. Right? So, this is not a new problem, the problem of evil, and it's really agitated with Jewish people. So, what we're saying is, so you're saying a hiding God, you're saying a God that's a very different kind of God, it kind of maybe emerges within you, as opposed to a supernatural God. Then we have those who say, a supernatural God.
What's the difference in what Ellen talked about and what we were just, what God gives or takes away, what's going on?
The hiding and the presence, and the hiding and the presence. Okay.
I mean, yesterday we talked
about... I think that's
good.
A fair reading of the text. Yitz Greenberg, modern Jewish philosopher, completely agitated about Jewish beliefs. What does he say? He says that God hides, not God hides, God steps back. It seems soon is to contract. That God can keep stepping back, and as he steps back, we have more power. Right? Just like a parent continually steps back from his child so his child can do what? Grow up. And a parent who does not step back on a child, what do they do to that child? What? Smother that child. That child becomes pathological. So God continuously steps back. Now, why is Yitz criticized so vehemently by so many people? Because take that to its logical conclusion. If I keep stepping back, where am I going to wind up? Out. That's why he's considered by some people a heretic. Because the logical conclusion of the statement is that God, first of all, like all parents, what happens to all parents, no matter what? They die. So the logical conclusion of it's a statement and fights this, but it is a logical conclusion, just has to live with it, is that God dies. And ultimately we become mature, fully responsible, powerful human beings with infinite dignity and infinite value, and recognize that about each other.
Problem I have in terms of the issue of a God intervening in history is that I personally feel very bad and angry about politics, but I don't feel angry about my sense about God. I'm angry at my parents' generation that they didn't do everything they could have to have prevented it or mitigated it from happening. I don't, in terms of my worldview, I didn't expect
God to.
Right? That God would have blown up the railroad track to Auschwitz.
Right.
In my opinion, men were capable of blowing up the tracks to Auschwitz. And unfortunately, they didn't.
Okay, great. So in other words, God, the Holocaust is not a theological problem for you at all.
No.
It's a man problem.
Yes, 100% good. Man problem.
By the way, that's a very powerful response. Right? I mean, that's what Eliezer Berkowitz says. And a lot of theologians say, listen, an earthquake is a far more problematic issue for God than the Holocaust.
But if God was there at other times, you know, I mean, he was there in Sodom and Noah, you know, why did he choose this time not to be there? I mean, when we needed him the most.
And that's the theological problem. So you're seeing all the debates about God. It's great.
But he wasn't there at the time of the Inquisition. I mean, let's look at some history.
Good. So you're saying that that kind of God response within history directly for you ended when? Look at history. History is very important. Ended when? Good. Think about it. You're right on the right track, I think. It stopped when? Well, you already said Inquisition, so it didn't go past that. Before that? Okay. Okay. The tradition says, and I think it's a fair thing, with the end of prophecy, God's active role in history, or that kind of change in history, that hand coming into the middle, the yad chazaka, right, the zroa netuya, the right hand, the outstretched arm, okay, coming into history and splitting seas, that kind of stopped.
Why?
Prophecy, destruction of the first temple, the literary prophecy we talked about, you know, the curved list, Amos, Isaiah, all those prophecies of 8th, 7th, and 6th centuries. Okay? Both post and pre. Both pre-destruction of the first temple and post-destruction of the temple. Although they perceived God destroying the temple. In other words, they developed a theology in which the enemy was the rod of God.
What caused the change?
Well, you ask. I mean, I don't know from God's perspective, but what do you think?
He gave us the tools and said, go for it.
Like a parent. Gives us the tools and said, go.
You have different generations growing up. At some point, he needs to come back and reteach.
Well, your child becomes 30, right? And screws up. It's very hard to come back.
Teach,
right? Yeah, I always wonder about that. These are, by the way, what we're doing right now is debating the issue of God, much like it's been debated for 2,000 years. We have some new ideas. I mean, Kaplan's is a new idea. Yeats's is a little bit of a new idea.
Since we started this particular discussion, we're trying to look at some of these 13 principles and which ones we're going to put on the board. I think the issue of the Holocaust impacts most on number 11, that God is the God who rewards the righteous and punishes the wicked.
Okay.
So probably, just for the sake of moving it along, I like to propose that we accept the first four that are listed there.
Okay. You want, so you're ready to accept God exists, God is one, God is incorporeal. I think everybody agrees, if God exists, God is incorporeal. That means God doesn't have a body. So there's not an old man sitting with a beard with a yarmulke and a talus hanging out of here. And if God is ontologically prior to the world, then ontologically means from a being perspective. All that means is that God is before time. Okay, that nothing created God is what it means.
God was first and then
right, created. Right. It's just a fancy way of saying God preceded every single thing, including time itself.
It doesn't say
that's the creation.
But doesn't say the chapter said creation literally means is right now, just the first four.
Creation literally? What does that mean?
We haven't gotten to the point of whether or not you accept that the earth was created in 6 days.
No. My mother has been saying, if you believe that, you're a fool. So even that was already in the 1200s. Now, all he said is what you have to believe is that God precedes everything and God that God somehow causes, whatever causes means. Okay, that's very open.
I'd like to not just let's,
so we just want to put 1 to 4?
I'd like to give the reason why. I mean, the people, if you look at existence today, and science today looks at existence today and also how we got to here. The current non-religious theory goes back to the Big Bang, but nobody's been able to say what puts the Big Bang there for. So there are the scientists that reached the root of belief in God by saying that the Big Bang is a concept, somebody had to put that in force. So that's why before we get into the qualities of God, is he merciful or not merciful?
Oh, we're not even going to do that today.
Okay. Not even on number 11?
Yeah, I guess we'll have to hear.
That's why I think that the first four, the Holocaust doesn't challenge the first four.
The same way it challenges number 11. That's fair.
That's why.
So should we just put one? Can do I hear a second?
Discussion.
Okay, we're going to discuss that motion.
I would go back to Seth, which is whether or not, I mean, if God exists, sure, 2, 3, and 4 follow, but even if you can't accept number 1, accept
the rest of Jewish life
practice and be part of the Jewish thing without any particular, I mean, you may have a problem, but you can do it and there's no...
What kind of problem? What's
that?
You have a problem?
Personally, when I say you have a problem, it obviously causes you some anxiety because it doesn't seem to fit in with a
lot of things you do to a few things you say.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to say Baruch Ata Adonai if you don't know Adonai is there. But, so that is the problem. But I think that you can still say Baruch Ata Adonai, not ever being sure Adonai is there.
Okay, not being sure and believing that he's not there are two different things.
Right.
One is doubt, and one is already no doubt about him not being here. So that's right, that's a distinction.
Okay, I mean, if you're sure, and but I don't think either way, even if you're sure he's not there, you can still say it for other reasons, because you do it, because you're kind, you can be great, great grandparents, whatever it is, you're still part of it, and it's the part that you don't, I think it's highly recommended. But not okay.
All right, let's put 1 to 4, we'll call them the God principle. By the way, Albo did do exactly that, by the way. He said, the God, all my Maimonides, he narrowed down my Maimonides to 3, because 1 to 4 were all 1. Okay? Yeah?
For the same reason I raised the issue on number 1, I think 1 to 4 becomes problematic.
Number 4 is that, okay.
If what we're saying,
then we created God, is what you...
Yeah.
Okay. So 1 to 4, either. What did you say? There was a good. What was the language you used? It was recommended. Is that what you said?
Yeah,
highly recommended. Okay, it's funny to put God in highly recommended. All right, we'll put God as highly recommended. Okay. By the way, what we do have to recognize that if God falls into the highly recommended category as opposed to the necessary category, it does necessitate heavy reinterpretation of the tradition. Right? Because it's very nice to say, because Bubby said Baruch Ata Adonai, you can say Baruch Ata Adonai. And that may work 2 generations, but I'm not sure that will work 8 generations. Okay? So there will come a time where highly recommended necessitates very serious revision of the system. That's perfectly legitimate. I have no problem with that. You know, we did sacrifices for 1,000 years, and then we woke up one day and the temple wasn't there, we had to say, uh-oh. And we form prayer, which is a pretty radical substitute for sacrifice. So I have no problem with very serious revision. But what we have to understand is the stakes are very high.
Let me throw
in a... All right, so we'll put a necessary 1 to 4, too. We'll have 2 lists. One person, right?
A whole different concept, maybe, off the wall. But, you know, a personalized view. How much does the lack of evidence the superstition play, if you will, in our acceptance of 1 to 4?
I don't know. You have to answer that. I don't know.
I'm at Rambam.
No, Rambam, there's no superstition. But he didn't ask about Rambam. He asked about us. Okay? Rambam, well, when you say logic, it's not logical for Rambam. What Rambam says is there are 2 kinds of truths. There are truths that can be demonstrated logically, from premise to premise to premise, and that there are truths that one accepts from tradition. Whenever there are truths that can be demonstrated logically step by step, and they come in conflict with the tradition must be reinterpreted. Because there's no way that the tradition can be illogical from a step-by-step perspective. There are, however, a whole set of things about life that cannot be proved logically or called demonstratively, step by step by step. Once one doesn't have those kind of proofs, there are other ways in which one accepts truth. One, Rambam calls, is authority or tradition. God as creator, Maimonides, there were two basic approaches to God in Maimonides' time. One was that God created, and one was that God had nothing to do with creation. God was just eternal, and the world was eternal, and there was no creation. That was the Aristotelian view. What Maimonides showed was that it was impossible to prove demonstratively, step by step, that the world was either eternal or that the world was created. And so he said, since there's no philosophical proof, let us, for the sake of our tradition and for our system's development, accept God's creation as creator because of all the things that it says, right? God's creator says that there's purpose. That we're not an accident. Those are very fundamental values. Right? I mean, how many people would like to think that they're an accident as opposed to purposeful? I happen to have been an accident. So I haven't worked out a whole theology on accidents. I feel it's really great to be, it is really great to have been conceived in a moment of passion rather than a pre-planned package. But I guess for the world, that's not such a great theology. For me, it kind of makes me smile. But my daughter was planned to because she's not going to be able to say that. But what's more comfortable? That the world is just, it's been here, and that's the way it is, or that there's a purpose behind the whole thing? What do you think's been the driving force in Jewish understanding?
Purpose,
right? Well, I mean, everything's been purpose. The most assimilated Jew who says, but I'm Jewish, is saying, but there's some purpose. That's really what I think Maimonides was saying. Now, what's very interesting about Maimonides is when he says, if you can't prove it, you're allowed to have other truths that you accept for different reasons, but if you can prove it according to the canons, the philosophical rules of the time, it must be parallel to what the tradition says, and you're forced to reinterpret the tradition, which is why the whole first part of the Guide to the Perplexed, he deals with language. All the language in the Bible is problematic. Any one sentence in the Bible is problematic to you, understood literally, according to the canons and the logic of our time. Get along with Maimonides' time. You gave one. God created the world in 6 days. Right? A lot of people believe that. And in Maimonides, a lot more people believe that around me. He said, you're stupid if you believe that. By the way, he was talking about abusive teachers. Probably one of the great abusive teachers in the history of Judaism. I mean, regularly, on every page of the guide, he calls people ignorant. And he had the most wrath to those who were religious. Quotation marks. He hated the religious of Israel. Because they accepted a lot of things based on traditions as opposed to based on philosophical proofs. And a structured, ordered way of believing. And he couldn't stand them. He called them the people who were outside the castle walking backwards, and inside the castle was God. Can you imagine walking back? And by the way, you know, we said that those were people who only studied Talmud. I think he would die if he went to Jerusalem today. Okay, so for Maimonides, and this gets back to, this really gets back to your point, not superstition at all. Superstition is, that's for the ignorant fools. We're leadership. We're ignorant fools. So I don't know how much is superstition. What I do know is that Maimonides posited God because there had to be purpose in the world. There had to be direction in the world.
Why is
it what?
Why is it not necessary to
believe God? Well, I don't know. She wasn't comfortable with putting it down as necessary. And because plenty of people in the world
do not come forth and say, I believe in God, and yet fully participate in this century's activity of Jewish participation.
And yet fully participate, is that what you said?
Fully participate. I'm not
she's making a sociological observation of the Jewish people. And we're trying to create a list that the Jewish people, that we can go out, this group in Houston can go out and say, listen, there are some fundamental beliefs that we have to believe that underpin the whole system. And if we don't start teaching them and arguing about them and looking at texts about them, the system's going to fall apart. So he's not ready to put that in the necessary. Although maybe in that sense, we're going to have to talk about it in very serious ways. It should be under the necessary.
But I think, my guess is, no matter where you come out on it, you can still participate. I mean, when the dialectic is all done, you're still going to be able to participate without making that leap of faith to God exists in whatever form, be it active in history, be it passive in history, be it through humans, be it humans determining what direction we're going by ourselves without God telling us. I mean, you may come back and redefine it in place. It may end up as semantic
right. When
it's all done. But to start with that as the premise, you turn off, I don't know if it's 20% or 80%, but you turn away a whole lot of people who can be actively involved in this thing called being Jewish.
Okay. I think then what I'd like to do is this. I'm going to try to get, I always like to create the consensus. I think what we can do is this. It is, I'm going to cross out highly recommended. That's too complicated anyhow. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put 1 to 4 necessary, but what I'm going to put is redefinition, reinterpretation, of God. That on the agenda for leadership of the American Jewish community and leadership of Jews, what's necessary is some redefinition, reinterpretation, reevaluation of God's role in the whole scheme of things. That, I think, is what UJA is doing by giving you a half hour of covenant.
Gary?
The positive thing is that it's 1 through 4
is the anchor to everything. But that's, I'll just so you know. It's not that. It's all irrelevant. It's all, I agree with Frank. It's all what's good for you is good for you. What's good for me is good for me. There's no reason for future generations to go along and follow the thing. Because there's no thing to tie it. They may decide, well, I agree on all these wonderful things that we do in our Jewish community.
Bye.
But, you know, the majority culture is Christian. I can call myself Christian
to do the same thing. I'm
still
a good person. Absolutely
true. That would be an anchor to everything. And that's what that is. And that's why it's necessary to let that go.
Then
we're
going to
let everything else go.
Okay. We have two. Well, no, we have two. We're going to move on. We have two different opinions. They really, what makes them similar is that what you want to do is say, God may well be the anchor, but if we talk about that right now without really understanding people's doubts and grappling with redefinitions and all that, we were going to turn off a lot of people and recognize we'll wind up excluding a lot of people who aren't good Jews. Okay? So what I'm calling for is our serious commitment to begin to talk about this belief. Because there's a lot to talk about. Last comment on this and we'll move on.
I don't necessarily defy what people should redefinition for faith. Perhaps, I mean, I'm going to come forward and say, teach them what exists already, not if each generation reinterprets. You know, you said it's good for the default demand.
No, I didn't say. But Maimonides' God was different than Rabbi Akiva's God. Or the.
I don't know.
Take a guess.
What you face?
Right. Maimonides' God was very different. Surely Maimonides' God was very different than most. No, that creator, omnipotence is not a given in the Jewish tradition. Crescus said God wasn't a given. That God gave up a Gersonides says that God's not a given. God gave up one of his powers when he created man, he had freedom to work. So, see, we get one understanding of God that's kind of the supernatural, all-powerful, all-knowledgeable God, but there are a lot of different definitions of God. So, and I don't mean to say redefinition means that it's a brand new God. All I'm saying is that the possibilities of understanding God are so unbelievably wide that you've just begun to understand God. That's all. I don't mean to say that it's going to be a radically different God or it's not the same God. Just
you know what might be a better way of doing that? I don't know. It helps me.
Okay.
God is God. And God is beyond our comprehension of his essence and what it's all about. We may approach him from different ways and maybe people come from across the two generations. But the entity is God, and God can be transcendent.